Hello again, witches, seekers, and friends, and welcome to the Fat Feminist Witch Podcast, the show where we do a little ranting, raving, and wand waving. I'm your host, Paige, and together we're going to explore magic and spirituality, social justice, the psychic realm, and most importantly, magic rocks. This very special interview with pagan geologist Kathleen Borealis is sponsored by the Can of Witches of Green Moon Apothecary. If you listen all the way to the end of today's interview, you'll get a coupon code so you can save 10% off your first order from greenmoon.ca. Hello, friends, and thank you so much for tuning in to today's episode. As you just heard, today I have a very special guest on the show, and she is going to talk to us about crystals and magic rocks. 2019 was the year that many of us had to start asking ourselves, are crystals the new blood diamonds? And honestly, the answer is both confusing and icky. The truth is, many mines that produce our loving rose quartz and our calming amethyst are anything but. Do our crystals carry the stain of exploitation and environmental destruction? And more importantly, the fuck do we do about it? So the question you heard me ask before, are crystals the new blood diamonds, was actually the title of a Guardian article that came out in June 2019 that exposed to a lot of us, for kind of the first time, the truth about where these crystals are mined. You know, it's very easy for us to feel so far removed from the actual mine, which can be on an entirely different continent, that it's not something we really have to think about. Well, that blissful ignorance is gone. In addition to Are Crystals the New Blood Diamonds, The Guardian also put out Dark Crystals, the brutal reality behind a booming wellness craze in September of 2019 as well. Now, I'm not saying these in a funny voice to make fun of it, because it's very real. What do we as spiritual people, as individuals, do to help this problem? Is there anything we can do? Do we have to stop buying crystals altogether? I mean, if we gotta, we gotta. But there are a lot of people that aren't going to stop buying crystals. So that can't be the only solution. So I'm very fortunate that people on Twitter hooked me up with Kathleen Borealis, who I actually do recognize from her podcast, Borealis Meditations, which I listened to in 2011 when I started listening to pagan podcasts. One of the first ones, very cool. So it's really exciting to have her on the show so that she can talk about this from someone who's really in the industry in that more far removed role, and as someone who understands the metaphysical draw to crystals and to crystal energy. I'm going to be talking to her about the ethics of buying crystals, if there are crystals to avoid, or how you can, first of all, make sure you're buying crystals that are mined ethically, and how you can start to make changes in the industry overall. This is a topic that quite a few of you have been asking me to cover since these articles dropped, and I tried, but to be honest, I couldn't find the kind of information that I was really looking for. So I'm really happy that Kat is here to explain it to us. Now, I've got some other crystal content going up. I've got a new book review of Shadows of Crystal Healing and Sacred Pleasure by Vanessa Cuccia that just went up on my website, thefatfeministwitch.com, this week. And tomorrow, Friday the 6th, I will be putting up a list of mines that allow you to come in and harvest your own crystals in a place that you know is not causing destruction or exploiting workers because of the worker protection laws in these places that I'm going to talk about. You'll be surprised how many places you can dig up your own crystals that are very close to where you live. Without further ado, I present to you my interview with Kathleen Borealis, pagan geologist and all-around super, super cool person. Thank you so much for making time on a Saturday morning.
Yeah, no worries.
Yeah, this is great. So, you know, just because you've never been on the podcast before, you are a geologist and also a practicing pagan. Why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about how you came to both those things?
Okay, so I was kind of a weird kid, which I think most of us were. And
happens.
I realized pretty quickly that I was way more religious than the rest of my family. But also, since I wasn't really raised in a religious family, I didn't really have like a, I don't know, I spent a lot of time like, my dad did sound systems, and so he would install things at churches, and so we would go to services just, you know, to make sure the sound was working.
Yeah.
And I'd be like, is this my religion? No, I don't like this. And then, you know, we'd get invited to, you know, something at like a synagogue, and I'd be like, is this my religion? Nope, that's not it. And I distinctly remember it was so weird. I went to the library after school and I pulled down like an encyclopedia of world religions and I just started flipping through it and I was like, is this me? No. Is this me? No. Is this me? No. And I came across animism, Shintoism, and then neo-paganism
Yeah.
in the book. And I was like, well, animism sounds right, but that sounds like not a religion, just like a descriptive term. Okay. And then I was like, Shintoism sounds the closest, but I'm not Japanese. And I was
Yeah.
like, oh, here we go. I'm pagan. That's the word I'm looking for.
This one fits right.
So then I was like, okay, now I know which section of the library to look at books. So
The library.
I think I came to it a little different than most people because I kind of found it because that's what fit what
Yeah.
I already felt. And I definitely, you know, when people say like which books influenced them the most, I have a lot of books I read that I was like, okay, well, this is not exactly it. This is not exactly it. So I had a lot of like opposite influences, if that
Yeah.
makes sense.
Yeah, it absolutely does.
And so I kind of built my own path out of things that I found that fit.
It was custom
So,
made. You custom built it.
yeah, exactly. So that's how I became pagan. And I also always spent a lot of time outside, and I was always really interested in the world around me. And I always took a bunch of, like, growing up, we had a lot of summer camps that were like, sorry, there's construction outside, that were a lot of, like, environmental science based. And so I took a lot of those. And I always loved how every time we learned something new, like how to identify different trees, which plants grew next to stinging nettles, always that will help if you get stung, you know, that kind of thing. Always just like, it was amazing. It opened my eyes. So I went to college. I had to take a science class. So I took environmental science, and then I took a geology class. And the geology class was really hard.
Yeah, I bet. I bet it
My
was.
brain just was having a really hard time with some of the concepts, and I was like, huh, this is interesting. I'll take another one. And then I discovered, oh, we get to go on field trips and go camping.
Well, I'd take that class.
Ooh, I like this. And
Yeah.
so I just kind of, you know, fell into it, but to me, it was always the perfect pairing because the more you learn about geology, the more you learn to read the landscape around you, and you're able to kind of see these stories of the environment you're in.
Yeah.
And these are, you know, like really, I think the term that they like to use is like deep time. This isn't like on a human time scale, this is on the Earth's time scale.
Yeah.
And really, I think the biggest impact on my practice was kind of opening up my mind to these different time scales and thinking on this broader scope.
That's something that I love about crystals and that I think about a lot. I'll be looking at a crystal that, I just bought at a store, and that crystal is like it could predate humans in general. It's so old, it grew for
Very easily.
longer
Yeah,
than this generation's been alive, and it's a little bit mind-blowing.
and it has a story. I mean, you know, the you know, there's kind of in geology, you know, we split everything into kind of three different rock types. So, you know, you have your igneous rocks, so that's from volcanoes and magma that cools. Sedimentary rocks is sediment, things that erode and then deposit, so like a sandstone, and then, you know, like re kind of solidify into a rock. This is also how you get like shales and from ocean sediments. And then you have metamorphic rocks, which I find the most interesting because you take any type of rock and you shove it really deep down in the earth and you subject it to really high pressures and temperatures, and then everything just kind of rearranges. and you get completely different minerals, and the rocks look completely different, and then they come shooting back up, and then you have this record of, like, this deep space within the earth. They're really cool.
That is amazing. It's like planting a seed.
Yeah, and some minerals you only get from metamorphic rocks.
Which ones? Like, well, not all of them, but
there are quite a few, and you know, it usually there's a couple really good resources where you can look up, you know, if you're really interested in a crystal, you can look up what the actual mineral name is, and it will have the chemical composition, and then also the actual mineral structure, and then usually the websites will also have where it occurs and what type of rock and how it forms, which, you know, there's, I think for my geology class, we had to memorize almost 200 minerals.
Wow.
So the ones that are used as crystals are kind of a subset of minerals. And actually, there's a vast amount of crystals that have different names that are all just quartz.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, some minerals are very highly representative in what we think of as crystals.
Yeah.
And some minerals aren't used as much, but are absolutely fascinating. So I think one of the biggest differences between myself and someone who got into just crystals is that a lot of the minerals I have are not necessarily pretty,
yeah,
but I find them also really interesting.
That is a little bit different. There's such a focus on how pretty and shiny your crystal or your rock can be. And I feel when I worked at a store, a lot of people would leave the raw pieces or anything that still had, like anything like a geode that still had outer rock still on it. They just weren't interested because it wasn't as flashy.
Right. I mean, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's just, you know, you kind of have a different, I feel like you have a different relationship with, you know, I tend to work with whole rocks, you know, with mineral assemblages in them, you know, so multiple different minerals. But that's just because, you know, for me, I don't think on a single crystal scale. I'm always thinking about the environment that it formed in. And that's, you know, really important to me. So I tend to work with rocks as opposed to just individual crystals. And maybe a good point to define this, that a mineral is something that has a specific chemical composition and structure. So it's how all of the atoms kind of it's called a crystal lattice. So it builds a specific crystal lattice based on its, you know, composition, and then that defined, both of those defined together creates an individual crystal.
Cool.
Or mineral. And a crystal is basically just a single mineral that looks fancy. Like, technically a crystal is just any, like, piece of mineral. But, you know, what we think of as crystals is basically, like, a pretty piece of a mineral.
Yes. It really is. They're just tiny little chunks of minerals.
Yeah.
I know, we call all of them crystals, even though a lot of them aren't really that.
Yeah, and ice is technically a crystal.
Oh, neat. I didn't know that. That's cool.
Yep. Ice is a mineral. So, you know, if you have a nice ice cube, it's a crystal of ice.
Well, that is how you... that you can just keep rebuilding your crystals every time it melts. You just pop it in the freezer. That's fun, and I... That's going to be one I'm going to be thinking about for a while. Might have to have myself an experiment. So that is super interesting. And I think you're right. I think you would have just a slightly different perspective on crystals as like a spiritual entity when you know the science behind them and the science about where it is that they come from and how they grow. It sounds weird to say grow with crystals, but that really is it.
They do. They do grow.
They do grow. And what you described really did sound like planting a seed and waiting for, you know, a crystal plant to come up.
I didn't really know that worked that way. I work a lot with volcanoes, and there are two different types of rocks you can get from magma. And magma is underground and lava is above ground. That's the only difference.
Oh.
And so if you have magma that cools very slowly, you get something with really big crystals like a granite. And if it, you know, erupts, I think that's a better word, and it cools very quickly, then the crystals don't have time to grow. And so you get these very teeny, teeny, tiny crystals. And so you don't really see them in the rock. So you can see how quickly something cooled based on how big the crystals are. And sometimes a volcano can have some crystals will kind of come out of the melt first. And so you'll get, you know, like in Hawaii, you can get these flows that have these beautiful olivine crystals in them because they're the ones that crystallize first.
Yeah.
And they pull what they want out of the melt. And they're like, I need this, and I need this, and I need this. And they build themselves up. And then when they erupt, what you have left is what the, you know, in terms of elements, the olivines didn't take.
Oh.
And so then those form different ones. So
that's
depending
neat.
On the bulk composition of your rock, when you melt it, different minerals will form at different times.
Wow. That's super cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That is so interesting. That makes me
you
think
can look
a lot
at,
of the crystals differently.
Yeah, so you can kind of see like a cooling history. So in science, what a lot of people do is they use these things, which I think everyone should look at. They're called thin sections. You take a rock and you slice it into this incredibly thin piece.
Ooh.
And then you stick it on a microscope and you put light underneath it. And then you can do, it's called polarized light. So, you know, people used to like polarize sunglasses and how if you like tilt your head,
yes.
then the light kind of changes. So you do the same thing, but you put one on the bottom and one on the top. And light, when it travels through crystals, will actually rotate slightly as it interacts with the structure. And so you get these amazing colors.
That is
They're
the coolest
absolutely
thing.
Gorgeous. So, yeah, thin sections are like, I guess, my favorite geologist secret for crystals is because they're just absolutely gorgeous.
That just sounds so beautiful. I can't imagine seeing it that close up in such a thin section. That would really show off a lot.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And then just, you know, something that looks similar, so like a quartz and a calcite, in thin section, they behave completely different because they have completely different structures.
Wow. That's super cool. Wow, rocks. Had a lot more going on than I knew about. So that is all really interesting. I love volcanoes and I love volcanic rocks. They're some of my favorite ones. So that's super neat to learn. I didn't know anything about the cooling. That's so cool. My mom's going to be really excited. My mom loves science, so she's really excited to hear more about crystals and how they work. So that's so interesting. One thing people always ask me about crystals and their function is how they function as like a spiritual tool. What are you actually doing with crystals when you connect with them or when you use them in a spiritual way?
I think that that's a really good question and a really complicated question and also kind of a personal question, because I think how you think crystals work will really dictate what crystals you're going to be drawn to. So if you think that how crystals work is focusing energy and that it's based on their structure and chemical composition, you know, that's one thing. Then you're basically what's important is the structure of the crystal itself, like the chemical composition and structure. That's what's important. If you think that it has something to do with how humans interact with crystals, and therefore the physical appearance is important and the color is important, then that's also going to change what you're attracted to in terms of crystals. And if you think that it's kind of a memory of the history that it went through, that's also,
completely
you know, that
different. Yeah,
they're completely different. So I think that, it's one of those things, you know, humans really don't like unknowns. That's just kind of how we're built.
Yeah. We're nosy.
And it can be very difficult to hold on to an unknown, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, but one of the things you do in science is you kind of poke at the edges to try to define things. So I think that with crystals, how you work with them is very personal. And because we don't really have a like verifiable, testable way to tell how they work in magic, I think what you need to do is do your own experiments. You know, if you have one crystal of quartz, of clear quartz, that works really well for you, try a piece of clear quartz that's maybe not as pretty.
Yeah.
And see if that also, I mean, because if it's just the structure and the chemical composition, then that shouldn't make a difference.
That's a good point.
Right? So just experiment and see what parameters it is that works best, that you are responding to with the crystal. So I personally work with whole rocks. So I work with kind of the history of the rock. So not just the actual crystal composition and structure. So that means that the ones I actually work with are kind of like the crunchy, boring looking ones. and they're usually ones that I found myself. And then, you know, I have a lot of really nice crystals that are beautiful, but I don't actually ever want to work with them, if that makes sense. Like, to me, I have them in my collection for another reason. And I'm never, you know, when I go through my box of rocks and I'm like, ooh, what am I going to put on my altar this time? You know, those are never the ones that I go for. The ones I always go for are the ones that have a story because I found them myself, or I know the story associated with them.
That's so cool. That actually, that's so neat. That means so much. That actually leads me into something I wanted to talk about, which was, mining, like being able to mine your own crystals, especially in North America. There are lots of, you know, kind of smaller mines all over up near Thunder Bay in Ontario. There's Amethyst and there's Herkimer in New York. Is that something that's like growing a little bit more? And do you think that could kind of change how people work with their crystals?
So the mining question, I think it kind of steps back to the whole extraction industry. And I did work in mineral exploration for a while, so I've kind of seen both sides. And the thing that I find is difficult for people, and it was difficult for me, is there's this want for things to not be in your backyard, right? No one wants a mine in their backyard. But I'd say that, you know, there's a lot of these minerals occur in multiple places over the planet.
Yeah.
A lot of them do occur in North America and in Australia, for example. And those are places that actually have mining regulations and labor regulations.
Yes.
Now, if people don't care where their minerals come from, there are other options, like in Africa, where there are not environmental regulations or, you know, labor regulations. And you're starting to actually see articles come out. You know, this is something that I've been kind of saying for many years, but was actually really hard to find information on.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the dirty secret in crystals, right? Is no one wants you to know where they came from and what the condition.
Absolutely.
But now there's actually articles coming out kind of showing just how bad some of these places are. And one of the things you can do if you're interested in a crystal is you can look up, you know, on these, like, I think Mindat has where the occurrences are. And so you can see where these deposits are. And yeah, a lot of the times these places in North America, it's not economic to actually mine them on a commercial level because they can be done so much cheaper in these other places where, you know, you don't, because there's always the kind of like the right way to do it and the easy, cheap way to do it.
Yes.
And if the incentive is just, if people just want cheap crystals, it's always going to push the mining into these, you know, places that are, there's no environmental regulations, there's no labor regulations. It's always going to push it there. So I think if people think about where their minerals come from, and, you know, personally, I always think you should just go get your own. I think that if you have a personal relationship with it and you have a story, I mean, it just makes it so much easier. But if you don't have the ability to do that, I mean, what you can do is just look at where a specific mineral comes from and try to find one that you know where it comes from. So you can do, so you can either go on these, you know, like mine your own places, but you have to be careful because sometimes they actually salt with minerals from other places.
Oh, of course.
So you do have to be a little careful about that. So I'd say that the best bet if you want to get your own is a lot of places have mineral and gem clubs.
Cool.
And rock hounding groups. So rock hounding is going out and getting a rock, basically. So rock hounding groups are not necessarily going to be interested in the metaphysical aspect of the crystals, but they will know where to get them. So if you are interested in getting your own crystals, you know, hooking up with some local rock hounds and going out with them because they're going to know where to find them is a really good bet. And it's always really fun, too, because it's kind of like a treasure hunt.
I was just going to say, that actually sounds like a lot of fun.
Oh, it's so much fun. It's so much fun because you're like, oh, I didn't find anything. And then someone's like, look at this amazing thing I found. And you're like, And then you, you know, like 5 minutes later, you're like, oh, look what I found.
That, oh, it's great. Man, that sounds like so much fun. I would totally do that.
Yeah. That sounds like, and if you can't, I was going to say, and if you can't do that, you can go to these rock and gem shows. And a lot of the times, rock hounds will sell things that they found. And so you can talk to the people who actually collected it, which I think is another good way to do it.
And it's so different from how we get our crystals regularly. There's so many people in that chain of purchase between the mine and when we get it. Is there anything that we can do to, I don't know, to kind of make a positive impact on this? Is there some way to create some sort of regulation with the people who buy and sell these healing crystals to kind of improve these conditions?
Yeah. I think the first step is asking where it came from.
Yeah, because you know what? A lot of shop owners don't know.
No, exactly. Where did this come from? About it. Yeah, where was this mined? And if you don't know, if something is not labeled where it came from, be a little suspicious.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of places, what they also do, which I've seen now, which absolutely drives me crazy, is they will take a mineral and they will, like, electrocoat it with something so that it's, like, different color. And then they're like, look at this new mineral. Oh, my God. It's amazing. And so I also tend to go back to the older books when I look at up crystals, because people have noticed that healing crystals are a thing now, and they're like, ooh, let's make this new one. Ooh, let's make this new one. And so I tend to favor ones that have, like, that you can look at a long human history of interacting with it, right?
Yeah.
So if you look up a crystal, you'll have this giant list of things, but it's kind of hard to trace where those come from.
Yeah.
And so I really like to go back, like, I have a really old Scott Cunningham book, and it has some, like, references and, you know, like, uses in other ancient cultures.
That's so cool.
Which you can then go look up, right?
Yeah.
So you can look up how is this used in, you know, by, you know, some of these, it's like, this is how it was used by the Babylonians. And you're like, oh, that's freaking cool.
Yeah.
Right? So I tend to favor kind of descriptions that have a longer human history, because my assumption is that if it's been used by humans for this for a very long time, that is probably what it's good for.
Yeah, that's they probably have figured it out in the last, you know, 600 years that they've been using it or what have you. That's,
and if multiple cultures use it for the same thing.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Obsidian is one of those. You can look up the use of obsidian anywhere where obsidian happens to originate, and it's similar tools and similar uses everywhere. All of these different people that were completely separate came to the same purpose with obsidian. And I think that's really interesting.
Yeah. And I mean, if you think of it similar to, like, how medicine evolved with plants, you know, they started a lot with testing plants that had a long history in medicine.
Yeah.
That maybe people didn't necessarily know how they worked, but over, you know, multiple areas, they were used the same way.
Yeah.
So I figure, you know, if we don't know what the actual mechanism is, we should go with broad usages, because that's more likely to be, you know,
it's a good place to start.
Yeah, what it's, you know, what it's strongest in. So that's, and then, you know, you also have to look at, you know, kind of your cultural biases. And if you think that sometimes what it's doing is working on associations within yourself, because, you know, I live in Singapore, and luck and fortune and, you know, prosperity is red and gold. And that's completely different from a Western culture where you always have green.
Yeah, it's very true. And the green thing, a lot of people don't even realize the reason green is seen as lucky is really just because of American money over here.
Yeah.
Like there's a few other little things, but it's there's a long history of witches and healers around the world using cannabis. In modern day witchcraft, more and more people are exploring how the cannabis plant can be incorporated into their spiritual practices. Green Moon Apothecary offers self-care, mysticism, and joy with a cannabis-infused twist in a subscription box that's delivered to your door for each Sabbat of the Pagan Wheel of the Year. Each box includes special curated items to assist with ritual and spell work, manifestation, divination, wellness, and self-care. The smokable part of cannabis is female, and when you grow the plant, you must elevate the female in order to be successful. That is exactly what Green Moon Apothecary wants to do, empower people and celebrate the spirit of the cannabis plant, which is why they strive to work with local and woman-owned businesses. Indulge in enchantment by subscribing to a Green Moon box or explore their many magical products at greenmoon.ca. Over the last 3 years, I've shared a lot about my ongoing journey to better mental health, and I get messages all the time from listeners who are also struggling and looking for someone to talk to. Unfortunately, it can be very difficult to find therapy that is fully accessible, financially or otherwise. That's where BetterHelp comes in. BetterHelp is an online service that can connect you with real licensed counselors who can be available on your schedule and right where you are. With 4 different ways to communicate and a wide range of specialties, there's a good chance you can find someone perfect for you, all without leaving home. Everything is confidential, and if you ever feel like your counselor isn't the right fit for you, you can switch right away. Not only is the service really affordable compared to in-person therapy, they also offer financial aid for those who need it. It's okay to need help. You deserve to get better, and you can start that journey at betterhelp.com/fatfeministwitch and save 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/fatfeministwitch.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, you have to kind of think about where some of these come from. And, you know, if some of it is, I mean, I think that with some crystals, what it's doing is it's working on your own internal associations.
Yeah.
And it's helping you fine tune that. And if it's like the color that's triggering that, you know, I mean, that's also important. So again, you know, there's all these different ways that you can think of how crystals work. And, if you don't, you can come up with a way for yourself, but I don't think that we have a universal way that they work. I think you have to kind of see how you work with them.
Yeah.
And what is important to you. And another thing I would say in terms of what that implies is if you think that it's the chemical structure and the composition, you know, the whole, just the physical crystal itself, the mineral, a very, very, very good option is synthetics.
Mm.
Because they are not mined. They are in a lab. They are beautiful. And they are perfect.
That's so cool.
So if what is important to you is the chemical composition and the mineral structure, just buy synthetics.
That's actually kind of wild. So many people who use anything for any sort of spiritual purpose, you know, they're like, I can't use anything fake. I can't use anything synthetic. It's got to be real. But you're right. If it's really just about that chemical structure, that wouldn't totally matter so much.
No. And then you know that it's not, you know, then you know for sure that it's not coming from somewhere that's ruining the environment.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
And I think people tend to want things that are quote unquote natural. And I think that's kind of a, you know, I understand why people feel that way entirely. But I also think that terms like natural or eco or green have become marketing slogans.
Yes.
Mostly. And that we really need to be careful about the impact of individual things. And if you may want a giant, beautiful, natural quartz, but if you can get a synthetic one and it has a lower footprint, because you also have to remember that if these things are being shipped from like Africa to North America, There's also the carbon footprint of the shipping.
Yes, absolutely.
And rocks are heavy. I can tell you from experience that shipping rocks is
expensive, I bet. Yeah.
I've done it a lot. A lot. So, you know, you also have to think about the carbon footprint. So I think that if you are working with crystals as a spiritual tool, that you really need to take into account all of these things.
Yeah. And I think like the articles and the information that are coming out are really kind of forcing us to think about that more, instead of just picking up more and more crystals, to actually really think about how we use them and what they are and where they came from. Do we really need this? So I think it's good.
Go
ahead.
I get all excited. And there's nothing wrong with buying pretty crystals. I just want to say that right off the bat. Like, you know, this information is incredibly difficult to find.
Yeah.
And I think that's on purpose. And so absolutely do not think poorly on anyone who had no idea.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and there's when you find out that you've been doing something and it's actually bad, you know, you feel really shitty. Like, it feels really shitty.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's totally understandable. And I think that there's this like need to like do a knee-jerk reaction.
Yeah.
And I think what we need to learn to do is when we have something like this, we need to like be like, oh, I feel kind of betrayed and shitty. This doesn't make me feel good.
Yeah.
Okay. That's okay. That is totally okay and totally understandable. And we need to be okay with that and then say, okay, well, now I know, you know?
Yeah.
And just forgive yourself for not knowing.
Yeah, because it's on purpose. You know, they don't really want you to think about exactly where these came from.
Yeah, they really don't want you to think about it.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, because you wouldn't buy as many. You wouldn't spend as much money on it.
Yeah.
A lot of people, since these articles, especially the two Guardian articles that came out this year, since these started coming out, a lot of people have been saying that they're no longer going to buy crystals, that they're, you know... Boycotting the crystal industry sounds extreme and like it's not exactly what I'm trying to say, but they're pulling away from using crystals at all. But what I noticed in these Guardian articles is that a lot of those towns and villages where the workers are most definitely being exploited, their economy is dependent on the crystal mining and industry.
Exactly.
So, and that's, you know, what is the balance there? How can you...
Right. Like, what is our responsibility for these communities that are based around crystal mining?
Yeah.
And I think being, you know, I feel like if you think about when we grew up in the grocery store, you didn't necessarily know where all your food was coming from.
Yeah.
And people started to really say, I want to know where it's coming from. I want to know the conditions. I want to know, you know. And I think that we need to start just insisting on knowing where things are coming from. And, you know, it's not going to change overnight.
Yeah.
And I think that just starting by asking, where is this from? If we can just start to get everything labeled as to where it comes from, then you can start, you know, to kind of ramp things up. And if we as consumers are willing to pay more for things that come from countries that have environmental regulations, then the economics might shift.
Yeah.
And if people see that, you know, the consumers are really, really want to make sure that, you know, they're mined responsibly and that people are taken care of and they're willing to pay for that, then the economics will shift. Because I think a lot of what happens is there are deposits of these minerals in the U.S., in Canada, especially, but it's not economic to mine them.
Yeah.
And I saw this a lot I worked in gold for a while, and I saw that a lot in gold too. You know, there's these awesome gold deposits, but it's not economic to mine them in the U.S. because you have to pay for all these regulations, and the regulations are good.
Yes.
I mean, I absolutely would prefer if someone said, here, the gold in your electronics were mined in the U.S. I'd be like, yes, thank you. I know that at least there were regulations, you know.
Yeah, those people were paid minimum wage. That makes me feel a little better.
Yeah. There is someone whose responsibility it is to watch, right? And I think that all of our natural resources, all of our raw materials, you know, we tend to just kind of like close our eyes and don't know where they came from.
Yeah.
And they're going to be mined. Period. End of story.
Yeah.
And I think what we need to you know, you're not going to stop mining. What we need to do is insist on doing it to the best way that we are capable of right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Chipping away at it and getting more to where we need to be. Yeah. I never really thought about the regulations of like my train of thought with crystals and the train of sourcing really stopped at like the wholesaler. I didn't really think beyond that. And when I saw those articles, I was like, well, of course they come from a mine. Like, I just never considered it because I'm so far removed. And that is not something I'm capable of now that I know.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you know, with any mine, you know, there is, you know, I mean, there is the expensive right way to do it and the cheap way to do it. So as consumers, I think we've kind of driven the price to like, we want really cheap crystals and we want a lot of them.
Yeah.
And I think what we need to do is step back and say, okay, I want a lot of crystals. Am I willing to pay more knowing that they came from a place where there was at least some environmental regulation and labor regulations?
Yeah.
And I think the first step is just asking, where is this from?
I think I would be willing to pay more.
Yeah. And if you don't know where it's from, don't buy it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So are there any, like, I know you can't like single out entire countries, but for the most part, when you're looking at your crystals, if they have some sort of location, are there any locations that we should see as suspicious or more likely to be exploitative, or even types of crystals maybe?
So one of the things I recommend is if I tend to be, I mean, in general, I am a reduce consumption person. So I don't impulse shop. I have a list. So if I have a crystal I'm looking at, like say I want to get a piece of fluorite, you can look up where it is mined, where the economic deposits are. And a lot of the times, the more developed a country is, the more regulations it has. It's just kind of a general rule of thumb.
Yeah.
So you can look at where the deposits are, and then you can decide which deposit you would rather source from.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
It absolutely does. That actually makes a lot of sense.
And, you know, I don't want to single out individual countries.
Yeah.
But the general rule of thumb is the developed countries have more regulations. They also tend to have less mining now, because it's not economic.
Yeah.
So it will be more expensive. But I think if we all start insisting on knowing where it came from, that is absolutely the first step. Like everything labeled, where did this come from?
Yeah, I think that's great advice. Because like I said, when I worked in a crystal shop, she had no idea where those came from, or even, you know, a lot of times that location on the label was actually the country of origin for the crystal, like right. where it was first discovered, not where this particular piece came from.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was just no way for us to really find that out even. We couldn't talk to the wholesaler or distributor and really get a clear answer.
Yeah.
So we really need to start asking the question. I think you're right that that's the best first step.
Yeah, everyone got super excited about crystals, and we all kind of had that moment of like, oh my god, this is awesome, I love it. Ah.
Yeah.
And now we need to like calm down and be like, okay, let's get serious about this now.
Especially because even I, like, I'm looking at my crystals now, and they're in a couple, you know, glass bowls, and I'm looking at a few of them, and I'm like, I couldn't tell you what that is or what that's for. You know, I was in the store buying the stuff on my list, and I happened to see something pretty, and I snatched it.
Yeah.
And now that I'm learning a little bit more about the mining, I'm like, I definitely just started buying a bunch of them and having a bunch of them versus exploring each individual one.
Yeah. And I mean, and that's why I said I have ones that I have because, you know, like I think the mineral is really cool or it was a really nice piece.
Yeah.
And those I have separate. I mean, I don't really, like I have these absolutely beautiful pyrite cubes. Like they're just gorgeous.
So cool.
But I don't work with those. I work with my like really grungy piece of pyrite.
Yeah. Pyrite's so neat.
Smash it up
too.
And take little pieces and, you know, I mean, like there's a difference between, I think, the ones you work with and the ones that you have because they're pretty. And there's absolutely no problem with having minerals because they're pretty.
Yeah. It's like the fancy dining room.
Yeah.
You know, parents used to have the fancy dining room no one could use because it was for guests.
Right. And I think, but you need to have a proportion, right? So you have less of the fancy ones that you don't use.
Yes. Yeah. My plan is to actually go through my crystals over the next, you know, instead of buying any more, before I buy any more, to go through them and like actually explore my crystals a little bit and take a look at each one and see what I even have. Because you're right. It's, you know, I just, we snatched them up because we got so excited.
Yeah. And I think people tend to overlook just going outside and seeing what rocks catch your eye.
Yes.
I mean, I have some pretty grungy looking rocks, but they feel really nice in my hand. I like the shape. And, you know, those are the ones that I tend to gravitate towards the most. And, you know, I pick up rocks whenever I go somewhere.
Yeah.
So I have rocks from all over the world now.
That's so cool. Well,
I also have rocks in multiple countries at this point and multiple parents' houses and
there's just rocks everywhere waiting for you to come back.
Yes, you say no one likes helping geologists move because we have boxes of rocks and books.
My sister made a similar joke. She's like, helping you move is going to be brutal. She's like, we just have tons and tons of stacks of books, you know, bowls and boxes full of crystals and candles, and she's like, this is going to be a mess.
Try deciding what to take with you when you move across to a different country on a plane.
All the huge crystals. Well, I gotta take this gigantic piece I found. Yeah, no. Oh, that would be hard.
I have like a whole box of rocks, and I'm like, these came with me because they're mine and I like them and they're pretty. And I can't be separated from them. And then you're like, I took up space in the suitcases, the limited suitcases I had.
Yeah,
for rocks. A giant box of rocks, and then I'm just gonna get more.
I respect it. I get it. They're interesting. They're just interesting. There really is just something about looking at these rocks, you know, just like any other rock we see. They just happen to look a little prettier, but, and thinking about exactly, you know, how old they are and how much of humanity they have seen or haven't, you know, they're such an interesting, I don't want to say tool, but they are. They're an interesting tool for spirituality.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, depending on where you live, the geology under your feet is completely different. Yes. And, you know, some areas like on the Canadian Shield is, you know, this stable core of the continent that has existed for, you know, ridiculously long amount of time. And then other areas are, you know, the very active edges where, you know, things are happening and, you know, there's earthquakes and volcanoes.
Yeah.
And both environments are powerful in their own way.
Yeah.
Like, I am on a very stable part of a continental plate right now. And, I definitely miss the edges where all the action's happening.
You miss the little, like, the strange rumbles.
Oh, yeah.
I was always on the lookout for strange rumbles when I lived in Vancouver. I was just waiting for it. Because where I live now, that does not happen.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and Vancouver's so cool because it has slow slip earthquakes. They're so cool.
It does. It does have. I never got to experience an earthquake, and I'm not super mad about it, but I never did when I was out there, and it was like on my bucket list. I'm sure it'll happen.
Oh, man. I definitely like. Wait, so I lived in Hawaii for about 4 years, and I went back during the eruption last year, and everyone else left the volcano area, and we drove right up to the top, and we're like, yeah, we're gonna stay next to the summit because we want to feel all the earthquakes.
Yeah. Oh my god, I would do that. That's awesome. I think volcanoes are so cool. It's insane to see the earth just like build a new part of itself like that.
Oh, it is like, I am so biased, but yeah, it is the coolest thing in the world to see. I mean, because it's The image I had last time, so I work on active volcanoes, so I go to them a lot, and the image I always have is like the mantle kind of like reaching up towards you, because they just feel so powerful when you're there. Like, even if they're not doing anything, you're just like, oh yeah, it's so close, you know, because it's like this deep engine of the inside of the earth, like reaching up towards you, because the crust, you know, like through the crust, it's, oh my god, I love them.
It's just so, it's one of those things where you start thinking about it and it's too much. Like when you start thinking about like how infinite space is, I feel like that with volcanoes, like this is unfathomably deep. Like I can't, this is so old spewing up out of the top here. And it's incredible that someone gets to see it.
And the secret is that they have personalities.
I bet.
Each one has a personality, and the people that are the best at understanding the volcano are the ones that have known them the longest.
Oh, the people, like the locals? People who live there around the volcano?
Or the scientists that have worked on it the longest. They're the ones that are like, guys, we should be worried now. And everyone else is like, that doesn't look too. They're like, no, I know this volcano. We should be worried right now.
Me and this volcano have a rapport and it's pissed.
We've got a history and like, yeah.
That makes me laugh. That's so cute. I just imagine scientists like, you know, talking to their volcano.
Oh, we do.
That's awesome.
We definitely do. I think Hawaii, I think is really cool because of the, I've totally got off topic. You've got me on volcanoes. But you know, with the use and I guess throughout the whole community of Pele.
Yeah.
You know, I think Westerners, we tend to think of goddesses of, and the way that Pele is, I don't want to say used, but if you want to translate the word, the direct word means magma or lava, because the way you speak about Pele is in a sentence, you would just replace the word lava.
Yeah. She is and the so, lava.
Yeah, yeah, it's literally just the magma or the lava. So when people speak about Pele and the personality of Pele, I think it helps them understand the complexities of a volcano much better, because, you know, it can do the same thing for years and years and years, in this case like 30 years, and then it will do something completely different. And, you know, if you're thinking on just like the little box of this is what volcanoes do, it can be very difficult to comprehend that change. But if you're like, oh, what's Pele up to?
Yeah. Something's going down.
Oh, yeah. Wow. She running. Damn. You know, I mean, like, I think the community in Hawaii is very resilient to being hit by lava flows repeatedly. And I think that's part of it, is that they have this, like, understanding that their volcano has a personality.
Yeah, they have that relationship with the, the volcano's personality. That's so interesting to think about. That's scary, but very cool. It would be so different to live on a very like active piece of land where, you know, new earth is just springing up all the time. I can't imagine. That's so cool.
It's so cool.
That's so cool.
And, you know, it's like a continuum too, right? I mean, like a mineral is the little piece of the lava.
Yeah.
Right? And the lava is the rock, and the rock is the volcano, and the volcano makes the island. And the island is on a plate, which is part of the earth. I mean, it's all one big system, and you're just looking at it at different scales.
Oh, that's so cool.
So I don't think you can separate. Like, to me, geology is the natural extension of being interested in crystals.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's true.
It's kind of like if you are really interested in plants.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of a very good analogy.
Well, like becoming a professional herbalist, even, you know.
Right, and you work with maybe like a leaf of a plant.
Yeah.
But you should probably know the plant and the conditions it likes to grow in, where it grows, where it comes from, and then maybe the ecosystem that the plant evolved in. Yeah. And then, you know, like you step up bigger and bigger and bigger to get a better picture of it as a whole, as opposed to just this little teeny leaf.
Yeah. Yeah, you have a wider image of everything that contributed to that leaf.
Yeah, and I think it's important for people to remember that there's this whole, like, I think it's called the Dunning-Kruger effect, where the more you know, the more you know you don't know. So if you start to dig into it and you get more confused, that's totally normal.
That's totally normal. You're on the right track.
You're on the right track. If you are confused and feel like you suddenly don't know anything, you're on the right track.
Yeah, that means that you found something you need to learn.
Yeah.
That's so cool. Well, that was all of the questions I have. Is there anything else about crystals and crystal ethics that people should keep in mind when they're going out. I mean, Christmas is coming up, and I know everybody's going to be buying crystals for each other.
Right. I mean, I think the biggest one is I would look up your local rock and gem club.
Yeah.
They're all over the place. They're great. Remember that you can't ask them what the metaphysical properties are of the rocks because generally not all of them care.
Yes.
So when you approach people about crystals, just remember that they don't always care about the metaphysical properties. And so if you go out with those groups, sometimes I think that there's, I mean, I try to be kind of a bridge between like the scientific and the spiritual community, because I speak both languages, but the reason I feel like there's a need for that is because there is sometimes this really big separation and this kind of like not trust between them. So just remember that when you start to go into kind of like a rock and gem or a geology environment, that they're very suspicious of anything religious usually.
Yeah.
They're so, they're scientists. So you're stepping into a slightly different world.
Yeah.
So just be really respectful of that and then you'll be fine and they're nice. If that makes any sense. Right.
Yeah.
So, your local rock and gem shop, Rock Hounds, a lot of the times there's Rock Hounds that have their own websites.
Cool.
And some of them, I mean, I've heard crazy stories from people that I've bought rocks from. Like, I have one where the guy told me about this abandoned mine that he went in to find it. And, like, it was great. It was a great story.
That's so awesome.
If you can meet the people and ask them the stories, then it's totally worth it. But, yeah, if you can find crystals from people and they are the ones that collected them, if you want to just buy something, that's usually a good way to go. A lot of times, also, rock and gem clubs will have, like, lapidary equipment so you can, like, polish
your
rocks. And so if you join the club, there's a lot of resources you can use as well. And then I would also say that people should start working with their local geology, I think is a good place to start. You know, if you got really into crystals and you have a bunch, then I think the next step is to start looking at what's under your feet.
Yeah.
Because that's going to give you, because if you're working with a crystal and you're holding it in your hand and then there's a ton of it under your feet too, like... That's obviously, you know, that's, you've got that much more to pull on, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think working with your local geology is really important. And I think a lot of people work with their local environment, but they forget the rocks.
I think that's absolutely true.
Don't forget the rocks.
Yeah.
They're really cool.
Rocks are great. I think that's really true, though. I think as much as we say, you know, working with crystals is a, you know, a very green magic or a very earthy magic. But a lot of people really don't think about exactly how much earth went into that rock and what kind of earth is actually beneath them. There's a disconnect there. And I think I think part of it is that the disconnect people have with science and magic or religion, which is just people need to just chill out about it. I love science, and I like scientists, so we can all get along.
I think that it's just, you know, we've become very much like art versus science too.
Yes.
And I think that it's, you know, a lot of the best scientists I know are also artists.
Yeah.
I mean, it's artificial. It's an artificial boundary, basically. And it's just, we've come up, we have different language now.
Yeah.
We have different languages and you have to translate between them. And I would also say that if anyone has any questions in terms of trying to find resources on the geology where they are, I am always happy to answer questions.
That's awesome to know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I used to listen to your podcast back when I was living in Vancouver, actually in 2011 and a little bit of 12. So I was excited to see that you've been doing it again or that you have new episodes.
Yeah, I'm trying. I've been work-wise, my career is going really well, so it means that I'm very busy.
Yeah.
but what I'm trying to do is it can be very difficult. I think you know this too when you do it by yourself.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to kind of grab people so that it's a little bit more fun and just have conversations.
Yeah.
And so I'm always up for new questions. And if there's any like event that happens in the world, I'm always happy to answer questions, or, you know, I usually try to put out something quick if it's, you know, something that brings up a lot of big questions. There's been a couple really good examples of the difference between triggered earthquakes and aftershock sequences. Mm. So that's kind of the most recent thing I was talking about. Yeah. And again, it's just, I find that a lot of the times it's a language difference.
Yes.
And once you realize what that language difference is, you're like, oh my God, this was so obvious. How did I not get this before?
You have to become bilingual. You have to speak, you know, metaphysical and science at the same time.
Well, even in science, like, you know, I mean, the big thing with earthquakes is people always ask, is this going to trigger earthquakes?
Yeah.
You know, can this trigger other earthquakes? And I think because in science, we have a specific term for earthquakes triggered by earthquakes. Mm. And then we have a study of triggered earthquakes, which are different. We think of them as different things. But actually, the aftershock sequence is all the earthquakes that were triggered by the big earthquake. So it's just literally remembering, not like just loosening up the terms and being like, oh my God, duh.
Yeah, putting it into a form people can absorb a little more.
Yeah, people ask this question every time there's an earthquake, and every time it's like, well, you know, sometimes if there's, and it's like, no, it's the aftershocks, duh, that's what people were wanting to know.
Aw, that's sad.
So yeah, there's no stupid questions. There's just, you know, like a little, usually there's just like this little teeny piece of information that's missing. So never feel like a question is too stupid to ask me.
That's awesome. I feel bad. I'm sure being a scientist and having people interested in crystals, especially if you're a geologist, interested in crystals, but not really knowing any of the science of crystals, I bet that would be a little bit frustrating.
Oh, no. See, I'm one of those people that gets like, once you get me talking, I just get super excited. So
that's awesome.
I'm always happy to talk about rocks.
That's the best. I have a million like sticky notes. I was actually really excited because I like rocks, and I like thinking about where they came from in the center of the planet. I love it. I think it's so interesting, and that we just don't talk about it enough in, you know, metaphysical circles. We talk so much about the color and the vibe.
Yeah. But not like the, yeah, I think the way that they form is sometimes like some are only made from specific other minerals that melt at specific pressures and temperatures and stuff like that. Like, it's just,
yeah. And how wild is that? Like, that just, all just has to happen at one time.
Yeah. And that you can hold something that's been down, like, I don't know, hundreds of kilometers and then come back up.
Oh my God. That's so wild. Like, that's crazy. It's so hard to think about how far down that is, but that is so wild. Yeah, I think it's really interesting, and I hope now that we're talking a little bit more about like the mines and crystals, that people will start thinking about some of this a little bit more and exploring more of the environment around crystals.
Yeah, and I think just, you know, being aware and, you know, educating people in a kind manner, I think, is important.
Yeah.
I know I had a tweet go slightly, I don't know what viral counts as, but, you know, it was very popular, but I saw something and I was just like super annoyed on my way to work before coffee.
Oh no.
And then I was looking at it and I was like, oh no, that was a little mean. Like, I usually try to be really kind when I talk about this stuff, but I was just really frustrated.
Yeah, it happens, especially in the morning before coffee. We've all been there.
Yeah.
It's so easy to send out 240 very offensive like characters without thinking about it.
Yeah, you see these products that are like ridiculously expensive for like with a mineral that you know is like stupid cheap.
Yeah.
With like zero information about where it came from, and they're like, this is going to solve cancer, and you're like, oh my fucking God, no.
Yeah. I cannot believe how much some people pay for you know, a bag of just little tumbled rocks, like 5 or 6 basic rocks. Yeah. You know, they got like a rose quartz and an amethyst. And it's just because they don't know that all of those are very like common and cheap.
Yeah.
And they paid 4 times as much as they should have.
You're like, oh God, please no.
I know. It's you don't want to tell them they were ripped off, but oh my God, I want to tell them they were ripped off.
Or when I go into like a metaphysical rock shop, and then I start Googling what minerals things are.
Yeah.
I've multiple times been, you know, like browsing and someone been like, oh, is there something, you know, like particular you're looking for? You know, like what kind of working are you looking to do? And I'm like, actually, I'm a geologist. I'm looking for, you know, like I'm just interested in getting a couple samples. People don't like that.
Really? I would be so excited.
because I think that they know that geologists know that like these five things that you have labeled different at different prices are actually all the same thing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You're pulling the curtain back a little bit.
Yeah.
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 Oh, man. See, I would have been really psyched if a geologist came into the crystal shop I worked at and was like, I'm just looking for some real samples here. I think I would have been really psyched and asked them a million annoying questions.
I know. Also, if you want to learn to identify crystals, if you can find a university that has, like, a community college or something that has a mineralogy class, the best way to identify crystals is to just look at a lot of the same one.
Ooh.
That's really, like, if you know, my husband is a petrologist and works a lot with rocks, and a lot of the times if I don't know what something is, I show it to him, and he knows what it is, and his answer is, 'cause it looks like it. Like, it's just something that you learn, yeah. Like with plants, you just learn what it looks like. So if you are really interested in identifying and learning about minerals, a mineralogy class is quite possibly one of the most challenging classes you will ever take, but also you will learn the most about how to identify different minerals.
I really think it's, I think it's interesting at the beginning of the interview here when you were saying your geology class was incredibly challenging and hard, and that made you just want to dive in even more. I love that.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of the opposite way that I expect some of those stories to go.
Yeah. So that's yeah. Really cool. I mean, I definitely remember looking around a landscape and being like, oh my God, no shit, that hill is because of a glacier. Whoa. Oh, I like this.
Yeah, that's neat. Especially in the Pacific Northwest, there's lots of glacier hills and glacial rocks and stuff all over the place.
We have, like, everything. We have, like, sedimentary rocks yeah. with fossils in them. We have metamorphic rocks. We've got volcanoes. Yeah, so I'm originally from Seattle.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's the Northwest is definitely, like, it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. I'm very But yeah,
I don't miss living in Vancouver because I need the sun, but I really miss a lot of the, like, the environment and the nature that I had access to out there, because it yeah. was something else, man.
Fun fact, I've now lived 8 years away from gloomy and gray, and it is gloomy and gray today, and I got very excited.
It's, like, nostalgic now?
Yeah, like, if it's gray and rainy, I'm like, oh, look how nice it is.
It's very Vancouver-esque, or Seattle-esque right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's some weather that I'm like, oh, it's Vancouver raining out there, because it's what we used to say was not raining, but it was most definitely fucking raining.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I'm solar powered, so that didn't work out. But I still have a bunch of BC jade that I brought back from there. Some of my favorite stuff.
Such cool rocks, yeah.
It's so pretty. It's such a beautiful, like, color and the structures that you could get it in out there. A lot of native artwork done with the nephrite yeah. jade. Beautiful.
Yeah, and there's actually a really big oh God, which mountain is it? There's one of the mountains that's I think it's Dunite. Mm-hmm. But there are these ultra mafic rocks, and so there's places in the Northwest where it's actual pieces of mantle that have come up.
Whoa.
And I think when I'm home for Christmas, we're going to go on Operation Get Me Some Ultra Mafics, because I know where they are, and I don't have a piece of Ultra Mafic with me right now. And, you know, I don't know. I find living in Singapore pretty difficult because it's so far away from kind of anything active.
Yeah.
It's been really, really hard for me to, like, ground really well here. So I kind of want to bring another piece back with me.
Have a little bit it's of weird. That home vibe.
Yeah, yeah.
A little piece of the chunk of the core of the earth from home.
Exactly. Yeah, because when I do grounding exercises, I ground all the way to the core.
Yeah. Super cool. Oh, man. I'm really excited about all of this. I'm really... thank you so much for coming
yeah, no
and
worries.
Answering questions. I'm really excited to... I'm really excited for this episode because I've wanted to talk about crystals a lot since these
yeah.
articles came out. because I love them. And I don't want to, you know, I don't want to give up crystals or anything like that. I want to find ways to make this better or work around it or something.
Yeah, and I think it's a pretty new industry, so you know,
yeah,
kind of shape it.
Yeah, absolutely. The next Sabbat on the Wheel of the Year is Yule, or the winter solstice. You have until December 11th to order yourself the Yule box to make sure that you get it in time. While you're at it, take advantage of their 21 Days of Deals promotion, which is running until the 11th as well, and they have a different deal every 24 hours. Now, the contents of the box are kept secret until after they ship, but if you want to know what to expect in your Green Moon box, check out some of their past collections, especially their most recent Sabbath box, the Samhain box, on which I helped collaborate. So head to greenmoon.ca and you can use the code FFW10, FFW10, to get 10% off of your first order. But remember, the Yule box deadline is December 11th. Thank you so much to Kathleen Borealis for coming on the show today. You can find more about her at katborealis.com. You can find the link, of course, to her website in the description. I highly recommend checking out her podcast, Borealis Meditations. A special thank you to the sponsors for today's episode, Green Moon Apothecary. I am endlessly impressed with this company and with the subscription box that I am getting from them. The collaboration we did for the Samhain box was truly really, really cool. And they are so creative, so smart. So thank you to them. And of course, thank you to BetterHelp, another sponsor of the show. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Fat Feminist Witch podcast today, for sitting down, and for learning more about how to be an ethical crystal consumer. I hope that this helps you going forward, knowing, you know, how to deal with issues like this in the future, how to make a better world through your spirituality and through your spiritual practice in real and tangible ways. You can find out more about me and the Fat Feminist Witch podcast at thefatfeministwitch.com. You can also find me across social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and even Pinterest. If you want to support the podcast, you can do that by going to my website and clicking the button that says Buy Me a Coffee to make a small one-time donation that helps keep the podcast going. Or you can sign up for The Witch and Bitch through patreon.com/thefatfeministwitch. This is a private monthly membership group that, of course, also supports the podcast and everything we do here, where we read books together and we have live meetups. And it's a great place to just kick back and communicate with some like-minded witches. You can also, as you could tell, advertise on the Fat Feminist Witch podcast. You can find all the links for this in the description for today's show. Have a wonderful weekend, witches. It's December, and the holiday season is very quickly approaching. Hold tight to your favorite piece of ethically mined amethyst and be strong.